Welcome, ladies and gents. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Pangdien from Sweden, and we cover, like no other, the culture wars, the attack on Europe, and dispelling the makers of the myth that all of this is somehow the most exciting, enriching aspect that is essential to the survival of Western culture. And as you know, nothing could be further from the truth. If you want to find out more, redicecreations.com is the website. RedIceRadio.net gets you directly to the radio show. As you might have heard before the previous show we did, we are reaching out to people who might want to work with us, especially on the production of video. We need live and broadcast people as well, but also post-production people. You know, this includes people in front of the camera as well. You know, even if what you do isn't that political or, let's say, news-oriented, that doesn't matter. If you share our concerns about the topics that we cover, please reach out to us. We are trying to pull something new together here, and we do want to hear from you. redicecreations@gmail.com. That's the best email to write to us. Also, when it comes to articles, writing original content, but also posting, news sourcing, etc., we have new updates in the works, and we're going to expand our news coverage significantly as well. So please send us an email, redicecreations@gmail.com, if you're interested. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. You know, if it's a right fit, it might develop into something more permanent in the future. We'll work out the kinks as we move forward, but we definitely want to hear from you, so do get in touch. Today's show, we have Christopher Hell with us from Sweden. He's a geopolitical analyst and a writer. A hallmark of his work has been the creation of online petitions on various important issues. In 2012, his petition to protect cash as legal tender in the Constitution resulted in a hearing on the issue in the Swedish Parliament. In 2014, he published a book outlining the dangers of globalization, Democracy Till Death, Sweden's Path to the Global Dictatorship. In 2015, he published a sequel summarizing the main points of a growing alternative international consensus on how the world really works. The Dark Heart of the West is the title. Christopher is with us to talk about Sweden's ongoing disintegration, the immigration problem, and previously unknown factoids about former Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme and why Sweden's political establishment, over two decades after the collapse of the Soviet Union, still haven't come to terms with the assassination of Palme, Sweden's role in the Cold War, and its relations with Russia. Christopher Hell, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the program. It's great to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
I am, and thank you very much for the invitation. Like so many others, I've been listening to Red Ice Radio for many years, and it's a wonderful source for new and exciting knowledge and information. So I'm very happy to be here.
Well, thank you, and always great to have a fellow Swede on the show, of course. I'm really glad that my fellow countrymen are waking up in the way that they are. There really has been, I think, a wave of people within, you know, within Sweden coming to these kinds of topics that we discuss on the program and others as well for the last 3-4 years. You know, when I started the radio show in 2006, it felt like it was very few within Sweden that was kind of on this page. And I think that that's also partially one of the reasons why I wanted to do the show in English, because I just didn't think it was enough attention for the subjects in Sweden. But it actually seems those shows have started up in the last couple of years or so are actually doing quite well. And there's a lot of Swedes coming over to our topics.
Yes, absolutely. The awakening is exponential in my experience. And I think there are several ways to indicate it. So this one is that since a couple of years, all the mass media in Sweden, big media, would you call it?
Yeah, big media is a good term.
Big media, yeah. Corporate media, that's the word. It has stopped people from making comments on their articles. And I think this is because of the awakening is sort of coming through, bleeding through in comments these days.
Yeah, always when you look at the comments, not always, but in many cases, you can see, just as you say, the fighting back, basically, and people not swallowing the narrative or the message they're trying to shove down their throats, and that's really encouraging.
It is, yes, and so I'm sure there's a market for a Swedish language radio show. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely, and there are a couple out there, of course. Motgift, I think there's Ingrid och Konrad is doing some stuff. There's many others. I think with some of the other kind of, you know, topics as well. So get to work, boys and girls. We need Swedish radio shows. But anyway, let's talk about you a little bit, Christopher, and tell us, or just kind of introduce yourself a little bit in terms of, you know, what you've been involved in prior, and then we can talk about some of your books or whatnot. But what do you think our audience should know about you before we get to our topics?
Well, I would be happy if they view me as, consider me as just a Swedish John Doe with perhaps a slightly unorthodox background, who in 2009 made a decision to go public or try to communicate what he or I saw, what was happening with Sweden and the world. And what I did was in early 2010 was to launch a website under my own name, christopherhell.org. That went well for 2 years and attracted a lot of attention. That was eventually shut down by after some actions involving the Swedish police. But I reopened and then under the name of christopherhell.net. And then for various reasons in 2014, I changed the domain name to blueshift.new. And that's my main site at this point. And I write articles a couple of times per week, or at least once a week. And I have about 10,000 subscribers, something like that.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, and you write, of course, in English too. It's not only in Swedish. You have a couple of articles in German, I believe. And is it Spanish and French as well?
Yes, some topics feel so important that I realized they should be available at least in English. So that's true. And I think one of them, the first one was about how cash is being eradicated from Swedish society. Because Sweden is the test case for this, the test bed. And I think they're pretty much done in Sweden. Not many people use cash anymore these days.
Right, yeah.
So I think this deserves a warning for an English-speaking audience as well.
Absolutely. There is actually a lot within that in terms of money and kind of the type of system that we're getting in Sweden that I want to do spend some time on later to talk more about. But tell us about some of the books that you've released. You have two of them out now, and I guess you can give us the English titles on those. How did you translate the titles of them?
The first, when it all started in 2014, when I realized that there might come a time when the internet is no longer around, at least not in this form where you can freely publish your own opinions. One reason for my concern regarding the future of the free internet was the creation of a private thing called Global Commission on Internet Governments, which is chaired by no other than Sweden's former Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Carl Bildt, seconded by former Department of Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff from the US, and also a less known British gentleman by the name of Sir David Owen, who has spent his entire career inside the GCHQ, the UK version of the National Security Agency. So I decided I had to take the most important stuff that I've published over the years and put in a book. And the first book came out in November 2014. Translated into English, the title is Democracy to Death, Swedish Way into the Global Dictatorship. And if I should mention something about the first part of the title, Democracy to Death. Well, democracy is about voting. You have a parliament that votes into existence various laws. The problem is that each rule and each law is sort of an encroachment on human freedom. So the more laws that is passed by parliament, the less free this so-called democracy is.
Sure, of course.
So yeah. So I think what I did was I pulled out some stats regarding Sweden because I'll pull back a bit here. Building a society is a bit like building a house. At the first, you have to put a lot of effort into it, and then when the house is actually there, you can sort of relax. You don't have to do that much. Maybe some maintenance now and then. If you use that analogy to building a society, it means that you have a phase where you have to have a lot of laws being created to build this society, whatever it is. And then when the work is done, you can sort of relax. And when you look at Sweden's society over the 20th century, you realize that Sweden was not that many laws were passed. But then in 1989, the whole situation just exploded.
Yes.
And from maybe having somewhere between 0 and 12 laws passed per year, you were not now talking several hundred laws per year. I think 1974, that was the year when the ceiling 100 laws was passed. Fast forward 15 years, in 1989, you had over 600 new laws. And this is 600 new things that Swedes cannot do or must do. The interesting part was that when you look at this peak in 1989, then the law creation in Sweden started to taper off. And what does this mean? What was this? had Sweden been sort of rearranged in a new way? Well, the reality is that Sweden joined the European Union. So, and then the legislation went up to over 2,000 laws per year.
God.
But these were laws made in the EU and then imposed on Sweden. And
right,
that's, you assume the situation is the same for all of Europe. So if you look at, that's why I call it democracy to death.
yeah, we're being utterly strangled with bureaucracy and rules. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe bureaucracy to death would have worked too, or red tape.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the interesting with that graph, and I can make sure to actually link to that, folks, so you can actually take a look at the graph for yourself, see the incredible difference between, you know, 59 or 64 compared to 1989, and then the very aspect that after this, in the mid early 90s, we joined the EU, so these, you know, kept increasing at that point, but. It's also interesting to note that this comes right before the economic crash in Sweden that occurred in the early 90s, and I can help to, you know, in some regard see that they're connected in some way.
Oh yes, you actually have the same person behind them, because one of the main speculators about this against the Swedish krona was George Soros, the Jewish billionaire.
Yeah,
and now he's at it again. He's arranging all these refugee flows, or so-called refugee flows, into Europe and Sweden.
Well, we got
same guy.
Yeah, exactly. And we got to definitely, you know, speak more about that later too. It's just a horrendous situation. I definitely want to get your take on what's happened. I'm glad you have your eyes open on this and looking in this area too, this controversial area, you know. But is there anything else you want to mention about democracy till death before we talk a bit about the latest book? I mean, there's plenty of subjects within there that we can dive into detail later, but let us know if there's anything there.
Well, it was written specifically for the Swedish reader who is familiar with Sweden and lives in Sweden. So it's perhaps a bit parochial in that sense. Then in 2015, the year after, I published another book, which sort of tries to summarize in a brief and simple manner for Swedish readers the main findings of this new wave of understanding that has come through, mostly through the internet and a lot thanks to Red Eyes. And the title of this book is The Dark Heart of the West, 9/11, Geopolitical Terrorism and Globalization. That's the translation into English of this title. Well, it's a summary. It starts with looking at 9/11, picking apart the official story, and then it moves on to explain what geopolitical terrorism really is. And geopolitical terrorism is all terrorism is state-sponsored terrorism. It's a tool to manage the large parts of the population. It really isn't crazy individuals or groups of crazy individuals. They don't pull this off by themselves, not on a large scale. It has to be a government or a government-like operator behind the scenes to sponsor this. And globalization, of course, that's the process of creating a global dictatorship on the ruins of countries and people around the world.
Yeah, it's very interesting, you know. I wonder too if plausible deniability in terms of the changing demographics of Europe is an excuse that doesn't fly, because how can they? I mean, I think that there's plenty of scenarios where some of the increasing crime and rape that we see right now in Europe is obviously, that's not a, you know, that in itself is not a false flag. It's these are, you know, I don't think they would be able to control it on that level. These are individuals that just kind of do what they do. As they're accustomed to a very different type of culture, and when they finally come to ours, there's no like kind of restrictions, I guess, on their behavior. But my point is, I don't think that the politician in our countries you know, are they, what I'm saying is that they are responsible in the sense that they must know on some level, at least some of them, that this kind of, you know, culture clash would occur by basically import, you know, a conflicting culture into ours. I don't know. What do you think?
So I understand the question to be, what do I think of Swedish politicians?
Yeah, well, I guess so. But in terms of them being able, you know, to have this as an excuse that, oh, we didn't know this would happen. Yeah, is that plausible?
I'm sure there are really naive people out there who are in politics. I also know for a fact that there are a lot of people who actually want this to happen. They want to destroy Sweden or any other country, European country, as they've looked so far. But I also think, could have been a guest on another guest on your show, the concept of control file or on someone. I think they're under a lot of pressure from their hidden handlers, so to speak. You don't become a politician in Sweden unless they have stuff on you, to put it blatantly. So there is a situation of blackmail, basically. They do what they're told to, and the only thing that might change is if the public stands up and creates a pressure that is at least as great as this, and makes it politically impossible to not follow the will of the people. So people has to actually take to the streets in a peaceful manner. In my reference.
Sure, of course. Now, do you have any suggestions on who is the kingmaker, so to speak, within Swedish politics? Who's the gray cardinal that ultimately vets who gets to become a high-ranking politician in Sweden?
We are talking about situation of trying to name people who are doing a really good job not to be identified. So,
right, yeah.
But I think it's quite safe to say that whereas in other countries, the banksters have usually come from a Hebrew or a Jewish background, that's not really the case in Sweden. We have the Wallenberg family, who plays a dominant role. The Jewish influence we have in Sweden, that's actually the Bonnier family, who runs a very successful media company. It's not only in Sweden, they control all media in Sweden, but they also, I don't know how many countries, it's a lot of other Western European countries, and well, that could actually also be the USA, actually.
Yeah, I think I actually had a number on that somewhere. Let me see if I can find that again. But yeah, tell us, while I look for that, tell us a bit more about the Bonnier family and how they became involved in Sweden and the way they are now.
Well, like many persons of Jewish origin, they tend to travel a lot. They're like the rich man's version of gypsies, if you will.
Right, yeah.
So they travel a lot. They don't have that much allegiance to different countries. They just move into a country, do their thing, usually very successful, and then they move on when things don't work for them there anymore. And I think the Bonnier family started out as, I don't know, panthandlare. How do you translate that into Swedish? Sorry, English.
Yeah, what I read about them, and they were basically, obviously they were in coins and jewelry and things like this, but that might have been later in the stage, perhaps, but they were kind of pawn shop people, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. Pawn shop people from Germany, they moved to Denmark, changed their name to Bonnier. The name Bonnier was actually not theirs at all to take. They just picked it up from some French aristocrat who had been killed a couple of years earlier.
Oh my God, why did they change their name?
I don't know. Well, that's a question you should ask them. what's wrong with the nice German name? For some reason, a French Bonnier seemed to work better for them. I don't know. So anyway,
Schmeckelberg Blatstein. Yeah, oh, I'm just joking. Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, so they come to Sweden and they set up shop and become a very successful media company that has kept expanding over the years. And so in Sweden, you have like there are really only two television channels. I know there are more, but I only see two. That's the state television, Swedish television, and then you have TV4. And then TV4 is Bonnier-owned and operated and controlled.
Zio TV, Swedish style. I think the media, the Bonnier or the media group, Bonnier Group, they write on Wikipedia for some reason there. But anyway, the Bonnier Group has 175 companies in 18 countries, according to the latest, you know, statistics on them, which is which is quite good for a family.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah.
And the interesting thing there too is, by the way, just as you say, there seems to have been a movement quite intentionally further north, beginning actually in the 1670s in the Czech Republic, and then into Germany, then into Denmark, eventually into Gothenburg, Sweden, and then up to Stockholm. So there's like a kind of a conscious expansion going from 1674 up to about 1820 to 1900s. Between there, the last people in the family, people at that time, actually moved up to Stockholm. So it's like a progression further up north to kind of take over territory to a certain extent, almost.
When you look at it in retrospect, it certainly does look like a pattern of some sort. It does, yes. So that would be in Sweden then, Wallenbergs on the banking side and Bonnier on the media side of things, as far as I know.
Yeah. The one of the other family members today, Åke Bonnier, is actually the bishop of the Diocese of Skara in Västergötland, which is quite interesting, right? That a Jewish guy is head of a Lutheran church. A Roman Catholic church, and then it was reformed later Lutheran. But anyway, go ahead, Christopher.
Now that you mention it, it did strike me, because he's always around when there's something going on with the royal family and in a church, like a wedding or baptizing or anything like that. He's always around, yeah.
What else should people know about the Bonnier family and their influence on the Swedish media? I mean, how powerful are they when it comes to controlling the message?
I think they're 100% successful in controlling the message within their own domain, and they pretty much own all of big media in Sweden. The challenge is coming from social media and alternative media, like you and I speaking now. And I don't have any real statistics on this, but I do take it as a sign that they stopped allowing comments on their websites now, because they don't like what people say in the comments. It's that simple.
Yeah. How would you describe the situation for someone on the outside? I mean, we speak about it a lot on the show, so I think the regular listeners at least will be kind of familiar of the kind of Sweden which we actually live in today. But let's assume you were speaking to a new audience here. What would you want them to understand when it comes to Sweden and the type of environment that we are living under right now? I know it's a huge question. There's so many different aspects to it, but specifically in terms of the media and how, and kind of the conformity of the message, etc., and the unwillingness of our state subsidized media to kind of offer a different, challenging opinion, basically, right? It's extremely conformative in that sense, right?
It is, yes. And I think if you're going to explain Sweden as we speak, it's in a state of free fall. I look at my window, I can actually see the flames on the wings, and I can see the ground rushing up towards us. This is an analogy, of course, but this is not actually my word, but we have ministers in the government who have said that Sweden is in a system collapse. So when they say it, well, I believe it, and I see it myself when I look at what's going on in Sweden. And in terms of how media is handling this, let's start with the structural stuff first. We mentioned the Bonnier family, which has a Jewish background, and then you pull a little bit back further and you realize there are other operators who also have a very strong Jewish influence. One of them is called Expo, which is a site which basically is the Swedish Åsikts police. How would you translate that into English?
Yeah, the opinion police.
The opinion police, yeah. So, and they're basically educating and informing journalists and school children all over Sweden what they should think and what they should not think. So there's an information war going on that side. And I think it's through that process that they set the standard or ramifications for what also non-Bonnier media may or may not say.
Yeah, we actually we got a nice mention in there a couple of times now. Thank you, Lehmann, so much for that. We'll take that as a as a badge of honor, you know?
Yeah, you could do that, yes.
I know we're doing the right thing when we get mentioned as extremists, you know, because these are extreme times and they have helped to create these extreme conditions, these volatile, ultra-left-wing nutcases are partnering up with some of the most violent groups in Sweden. You know, they are the ones who need to answer the questions here, not us. We are trying to bring balance, tradition, and wholesome values and morals, and we are working to prevent the displacement of our people that is occurring against our will. So they know they are losing ground. That's why they're lashing out in this way, in clear desperation and helplessness. They are utterly demoralized. And another thing, they are the liars, you know. They are the ones who are lying, skewing statistics and not looking at reality.
Yeah, actually, I had some fun with them because they put out an ad this summer, last summer, 2015, and asked, they needed some extra editors for the summer, and I applied.
Oh, awesome. Excellent.
I put it up as an article. I thought it was fun.
What happened, by the way? How did that pan out?
No official and no non-official response. So we were obviously a joke, but it was...
Right.
Sure. I think you should still have the lines of communication open with people. They're trying to create conflict. People should be shouting and yelling at each other. I think people need to calm down a bit and start talking about the facts. To me, that's the way forward.
Well, exactly. I mean, because, I mean, let's face it, they are in a position right now where they are actively trying to get people to not resist or demonstrate or complain, if you will, about their planned genocide, right? They're trying to guilt shame you into going along with the plans of the elite so that you know, won't kind of break ranks and do something which is forbidden in Sweden. And this is true in many other countries, but the fact is they are doing it on such a level that they are trying to shame you in a position of just going along with the agenda at hand. They're very skilled at this, of course, in the way they do it and everything else. But despite all that, it seems they are not really succeeding. And a lot of people are actually turning on them for their insincerity, for their blatant, like, you know, unwillingness to recognize that the type of opinions and politics that they advocate is destroying Sweden.
Yes, yes. And I think they realized the situation and done it long while ago. And what happened quite recently is that about the same time that the Swedish government changed its policy on immigration and introduced these ID controls on the border between Denmark and Sweden, also the media also changed its narrative, actually 180 degrees. So nowadays they're talking a lot about this phenomenon of group rapes of women in public places.
Right.
There's a name in Arabic for it. I think it's Taharush or something.
That's right.
And this is that's now in the mainstream media in Sweden. So either they've come over to on our side or they're actually pushing a new agenda. I'm still trying to figure this out.
Could it be that they've kind of been given the go-ahead by, since the government has decided to address it as a problem and as an issue, this have given them, you know, de facto the go-ahead to try to, you know, understand the situation and also complain on it. What I'm saying is that since they're ultimately a government-subsidized entity, they wouldn't strike against the hand that's feeding them, right? So they have to kind of get the go-ahead to write about this, that, or the other. Is that a good enough explanation, do you think, or something else going on?
Oh, I think that's exactly what's going on. And I think it could be that the globalists are so desperate these days that they're pretty much ready to do anything as long as they keep the emotions high among the general part of the population. Because if people start to calm down and see things clearly, I think they're afraid that their game is up.
Interesting. Okay, well, I would kind of assume that they're trying to keep it on that level, right? That they're trying to keep things very passive and very basically to... That's why they not only avoid a lot of issues, but they downplay them constantly, right? So that they're trying to not get people emotionally involved. That's kind of my assumption, but that's interesting that you have a different take on that.
Well, I think until a certain, I think it's a very good way that you put it in, up until a certain point, they want to keep it all under the rug and no one knows what's going on. Once the information reaches the surface, breaks the surface, they need to handle it in a different way. And what they can do is then to inflame it, throw a lot of emotions into it. And what better way to do that than connect violence with sex and innocent women on the street? And then suddenly they turn it from ignorance to confusion because everyone is so angry. It's just my guesstimate here.
It's a good point, Christopher. You know that. So there's been a shift. When would you say then? In the last couple of months, then, right? Because I know that there's some.
I think it started on New Year's Eve with the events in Köln and also in Sweden, actually.
Right. Well, I know that there was a couple of papers before this that were kind of beginning to break ranks a little bit. What was it called again? I'll find it here later. But I think even GP, Göteborgs-Posten, and the Gothenburg Post were taking a little bit more critical stance earlier this year. You had a couple of online papers, like I think it was Dagens Industri or something like that, actually, too. Or some kind of some business-oriented paper that actually started to write quite critically of immigration, at least from an economic kind of perspective, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they may have changed tactic or strategy now to use the immigration card to inflame, set Sweden on put Sweden in flames instead of just keeping it on the rug.
And how do they want to use this situation? Tell us more about that.
Well, this is just speculation, of course, but I think British media reported, this is almost a year ago, that ISIS would actually went out public and said, we're going to ship ISIS, so-called ISIS terrorists, to Europe under the cover of being refugees. And we know for a fact that we have ISIS terrorists in Europe and also in Sweden. I think the German authorities has confirmed this. So the next thing would be, the expectation would then be, okay, will these guys now start go through with the regular terrorist acts? Well, they haven't so far. What has happened is that they've started doing this Taharosh thing in the streets of Europe, northern Europe. Should terrorists now start run and mock in the streets of Sweden? The police and the government would need to act. They would have no choice. So when instead you have the sexual assaults, organized sexual assaults, the situation is different because the state, the police can still play a little bit more passive role. And this would then result in a conflict between Swedish citizens and these so-called refugees. And then you could have like a civil war situation, and that would allow the police and the state to declare martial law like they did in Paris. So my suspicion is that they don't want to be acting on this. They want it to continue to grow, these sexual assaults.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why they've kept it under the rug too? So for such a long time, in other words, the more they deny it, they know that there will be kind of a grassroots anger from people who are obviously putting 101 together and doing the math on this.
Could be. I think what their favorite scenario it would be if Swedes turn against refugees or so-called refugees. What they don't want is the government doesn't want to take responsibility and actually do something about it, which they should do because they've been elected to do it. So,
yeah, of course. Well, my point as well has been, you know, that many in the alternative kind of news world have used that type of argument almost as an excuse to not do anything, right? In some cases, they can use the rhetoric. I think this has changed in the last couple of years, to be honest. But for a while, it was very popular to say, well, don't divide us, or, you know, they're trying to, you know, create a division. Don't focus on that kind of thing. It's in my view obvious that the immigration question itself has been created to divide the Swedish people, you know, because this is causing families to fall apart and friendships to break and relationships to crumble over the fact that some people see the negative effects of immigration and some continue to deny it, right? But the point I'm getting to here is that we have to obviously do something. We have to maybe not only react, but we have to respond and do so in a in a collected manner, in a strategically good way, so that we can prevent this from happening. But what do you see in terms of how we can counteract this without then falling into their trap, if you will, that's been laid for us?
Well, it has to be, I think, the smoothest way out of this is to, for the public in Sweden, or to make such a statement to the government that the government starts acting responsibly. They've already made a 180-degree turn. I think it was 12th of November last year when they introduced these ID controls over the borders. But that's not enough by any stretch of the imagination. They need to do more. They need to start sending recently arrived refugees back home. Let me rephrase that. So-called single men, men without families.
Yes.
Because they're the problem. If you have a family, I don't see. You have to. Yeah, sure, they can be refugees. But if you're a single man arriving in a foreign country, what are you? Are you a refugee or are you a deserter from your own country? Maybe you should stay and help your countrymen out.
Yes. Exactly.
So that's an argument, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, naturally. I mean, the damage is already done as far as I see it. Even if they close the borders now and try to, just as you say, it's too late. I mean, there's, 40,000 people that have gone underground in Sweden? They don't even know where they are. These are obviously people that, if they're not part of the system, if they're not part of the structure of, even getting handouts from the government, these people will have to clothe themselves, feed themselves, house themselves in some manner, which means that they will probably turn to a life of crime, right? The black market and all these kinds of things, drugs, who knows what, in order to pay their way, to survive.
Some of them would certainly be financed by George Soros, I'm sure.
Yeah, they get lots of money, that's a good point, yeah.
But only the key individuals in whatever is going on. But I have a wonderful solution to this. Why not have a temporary amnesty where you offer all these so-called illegals, people are here in Sweden without having the right legal right to be so. You basically offer them money. Here, a lump sum. We pay your ticket, go home, have a brand new start of your life, better life in your own country. I'm sure some of them would take the offer, because it can't be that easy to be an illegal in a foreign country.
Right. Either way, we end up paying for it, huh?
So then the police wouldn't have to chase them. The police would just have to open the doors and welcome everyone who comes to them for assistance.
Right.
Maybe it's naive, but I think it should be tried, because it would cost a lot of money to chase them down, if it were possible to do that.
Well, the question is, what will cost more at this stage to let them just roam and create damage, it's unsustainable. It just won't work to have a society in the long run in that way.
No, it's a win-win situation, the proposal I just outlined, I think. Who knows?
Well, let's see here. There's so many. I mean, this is just such an incredibly worrying situation to me. It's aggravating. It has created a sense of anger and frankly hatred in me, because of the people who have allowed this to happen, and then also, of course, the responsibility of those who are performing these acts, whether or not they are paid for, whether or not they're just acting in their own accord. This is utterly unacceptable, and it's something that has changed our country into one of the most dangerous countries in Europe right now, especially for women, of course, where the rape rates are just skyrocketing through the roof, and then continuously it's being denied, and whoever points it out is, they're the problem. They're the racist, crazy right-wing fascist, right?
Yeah, but that's the globalist agenda, to destroy each nation around the world. The way they do it with Sweden is through what's going on here. Sweden has the second highest rape per capita figure in the world. I think there's the top notation goes to Lesotho in Africa. I think it's a small country down there. And then you have Sweden, and it's the top rape country in Europe for sure.
Oh yeah,
per capita. So
it's unbelievable when you think about it, isn't it? I mean, I don't know how old you are. You don't have to tell us if you don't want to. But I mean, how have you? I mean, you have seen the country change in your lifetime too, right? I mean, an incredible transformation for the worse. I sound like Barbara Spector there, but transformation, right? But,
yeah, I was a grown man when Olof Palme was killed in 1986. So
yeah.
The change is unbelievable.
Remarkable. Well, tell us about how this, I know that you write in your latest book, The Dark Heart of the West, you do write about, you know, Kudenhof Kalergi. We've spoken on him. We brought him up on the program many times. He really deserves much more attention, in my opinion. We are planning to do a video on this guy, a real expose of who, you know, who he was, what his plan was, how his plans are being, you know, coming into fruition by the elites, by the establishment within Europe. But what can you say about him and the way that his ideas are coming into fruition right now?
Well, I can have two. I'll pursue two strains here or paths. The first is how I became aware of that, about this. One of the upsides of publishing, having your own website, is that sooner or later people will start offering information. And there was a, I believe, quite old German fellow who contacted me and informed me about this Kalergi. And this was before it became mainstream in alternative media as it is today. So I was basically tipped off. You should look at this. And I did. And wow, yeah. You have this Greve. How do you
Count that? Count, really.
This Austrian count. He has a Japanese mother, so maybe he had a problem identifying with Europe and Austria 100%. So
of course,
he sort of embraced these ideas of globalism. There should only be one people on the planet, etc. I'm just basically guessing here. But anyway, I think the crucial point here is that at some point, Rothschild, some leading Zionist U.S. power brokers in the early first half of the 20th century sort of got the attention of what this man was doing, writing, and they sort of sponsored him from then on. And they created some society which today offers the Kalergi Prize after this Count Kalergi. And they give it to every person within the European Union that works the agenda of globalization and destroying the peoples of Europe, basically. I mean, if you look at mainstream media, you probably wouldn't have heard of this yet, but you actually have European Member of Parliaments who warn about this at the Parliament meetings in Europe.
Yeah, like some of the who was it? I think it was Nick Griffin from BNP has talked about it.
UKIP.
UKIP, yeah.
I think so. Well, maybe there are more than one then, yeah.
Yeah, there are a couple. Let me just, or do you want to, I don't know if you have his, one of his infamous quotes at hand in terms of what Kalergi actually said.
Not in English, I'm afraid.
Okay, let me read here then. I can actually, the man of the future will be a mongrel. Today's racist and classist will disappear, owing to the disappearing of space, time, and prejudice. The Eurasian Negroid race of the future, similar in its outward appearance to the ancient Egyptians, will replace the diversity of peoples with a diversity of individuals. Ah, isn't that pretty? So, and he's go further.
It's a wonderful vision, yeah.
Yeah.
We should all sit down together and sing Kumbaya. Yeah.
Absolutely. And but we should forcefully, you know, breed people out of existence too. But that's fine.
They didn't mention the Taharuj part of it, though.
No, exactly. That it will be for. Well, see, this is the thing here. If we take his quote and listen to that of his, you know, breeding experiment or whatever we shall call it. I mean, it's really white genocide. That's what it is. The Europeans is a distinct group. We are adding to the human biodiversity of this planet. And when they're being targeted in this way, it's a crime of you know, unmentionable proportions. But obviously this would imply that unless it's forceful rape, just as we see now, this would still imply that the men and the women would voluntarily, you know, or intentionally go with someone of another race to make this come true. And frankly, with these divisions that are occurring right now within Europe, that seems less and less likely, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think they're having big problems implementing this, especially how some countries in Eastern Europe has awakened really, really rapidly to what's going on. I think specifically about Hungary.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, they have problems implementing this globalist agenda.
Do you think it is that they're trying to do I don't know what to call it. Maybe there is a strategy, a name for it. But basically, what I'm seeing here is that what if they're trying to coax out the quote extremists, you know, unquote. If we're thinking about the strategy of basically creating a situation that it's so bad that it forces people into a position of fighting back against it, antagonizing it, and in fact when they do this, they will also kind of expose themselves, at least as far as the system is concerned, as dangerous, maybe as terrorists, as people who want to destroy democracy, etc. You know, they can slam all the, they're racist, obviously, they can slam all these labels on these people and ultimately go after them or targeting them. But do you think it's almost like that they're trying to create catastrophic conditions that ultimately is going to lead to kind of a civil war within Europe? But when this is over, let's say when the majority of people have been, you know, slaughtered on this altar of multiculturalism, a third world war, if you will, that there's then thinking, okay, but when this time is over, those people that still will be here are going to basically adapt themselves to a new world order, in that sense that they will willfully say, well, kind of like they said after the Second World War, this has to end, this will never happen again, we have to do everything we can to prevent this from happening, and that's a position where people would voluntarily kind of think of let's say a monoculture as opposed to individualistic nations or something like that. What I'm saying is that it kind of happened in Northern Ireland too, by the way. They after a while the authorities actually backed down, and they, you know, when the fighting was going on, and they did it to such an extent that those who were, you know, most extreme basically took each other out. And then what was left was kind of those who didn't have that many objections to it. There were more kind of the docile population, if you will, that remained. I don't know if you follow my train of thought there.
The revolution eats its own children, is a saying. If you use violence, that's probably how we're going to end up being consumed by it. But I have a wonderful clip on my website, blueshift.new. I don't have the name of this lecturer at time, but it's a researcher with a military background who has investigated successful revolutions throughout the world for the last couple of hundred years. And the very stark conclusion is that the most successful revolutions were people that sort of actually changed the society to what they wanted to be and not someone else higher up above has been through non-violence.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way forward.
How do we respond to this violence against us, though? I mean, we can't. What do you? I mean, I'm not asking you to come up with the strategy right here and now. But we have to fight back, right? I mean, we have to push these people out. They have to be physically removed from our countries, right?
I found this researcher at TED. Her name is Erika Chenoweth, and she found out that the less violence used in the revolution, the better the society actually turns out after the revolution. There is this saying that the end justifies the mean. I think it works the opposite way around, that the means sort of colors the outcome. So if you do it the right way, the outcome will be so much better. I think non-compliance is a wonderful way. The powers that be, they know how to handle violence. They don't know how to handle non-compliance. So I think that, and also if you want to make a real sort of military style an analysis of this, you could say that if you consider two scenarios, civil war versus non-compliance, during which the government would kill civilians, you actually have to compare the numbers. If you have a civil war, would that cause more casualties and trauma within the public than the situation where the public is just non-compliant and friendly and the government is doing all the violence? I think if you compare the numbers, the first scenario with the civil war is much, much worse in numbers of casualties than the non-compliance version. The only circumstance under which this assumption might not hold water is if the human component is removed from this equation and the government decides to rely on machines to do the killing, drones and terminators. I don't know. I'm just, these are some of my thoughts. I have no experience of these things at all. So
I agree with you. Don't get me wrong, folks. I'm not advocating violence. You know, I'm just talking about from a historic position point of view. In terms of what has been successful versus what hasn't been successful. I mean, I think what happens right now is that Europeans are not being violent. Swedes are not being violent. Very few cases here and there. Like, for example, they burn an intended asylum facility, for example, where there's no people in there. There's obviously a way of protesting against this. But we are not the one who's doing the raping. We are not the ones who are doing the stabbing and the shooting and the bombing, right? So and when you think about that, that is actually being used ultimately against them, obviously. I mean, the majority of more and more Swedes are waking up to this. They're sick and tired of it. They don't want to have this kind of society. So if they keep this up, they will lose at the end because people want to have a political solution to this. And that, you know, can obviously be nonviolent.
Absolutely. Just look how the Soviet Union fell apart. Was there even a single shot fire? I don't know.
I didn't hear it. Yeah, no. I know. Shell in one of the government buildings from a tank or something like that. But yeah, I get your point.
Yeah, you're right. There was this guy who climbed up on a... but that was a coup, I think, with Yeltsin involved.
Right, right.
I don't know if anyone got hurt there, but...
Yeah. Well, I think the government office was empty or something like that, I think. But, if we think about it, though, I mean, if we go back further back in Russian history... and look at the Russian Revolution, 1917, also actually fairly bloodless. It was afterwards that the bloodshed began. I mean, one of the biggest mass murders in human history occurred against the Russian people by the Bolsheviks, you know. But the damage was done. That's my point, too, that the type of society that they wanted to build, if they were sincere, obviously didn't work out, but... If the plan was, for example, from the position of the globalists to destroy Russia, to tear it down, then it was a successful plan. And the same thing might happen with Europe.
Yes, sure. You can, yeah. We live in interesting times.
Yeah, you can say that again. It's just really bizarre.
And it was really for this purpose that I wrote specifically the second book, which is it's not very focused on Sweden, but... trying to explain what I see as the basic way the world actually works. You have some hidden cabal of masters of the universe, financial oligarchs, I call them, banksters, who is sort of pulling the strings and creating all these events we see around ourselves these days for some time. So this was a... This is basically my idea, just to get the message out there before it's too late, to make people think in terms of how the world really works.
Before the civil war begins, or whatever we want to call it.
Yeah, and I'm already there now. They need it now. Yeah. Soon it won't make much difference.
Well, you know, we have tons. There's so many more things I want to ask you about in terms of what you write in the book and some of your. You know, personal opinions. You cover so many issues in the books, both of them, including, of course, the money aspect, what's happening there right now in Sweden. Let's definitely talk about that in the second hour a bit more. I think you also obviously the bank system, the economy, and all these kinds of issues that there's tons there to discuss. But why don't you give us some of the details of where people can pick up copies of your book, Christopher? Are they, paperbacks, hardbacks, or is there ebooks at this stage?
No ebooks, paperbacks. The one-stop shop for it is to go to blueshift.new. The domain, top-level domain is NU, November Uniform. And there you find it on the right side. The books also have direct links, but they're too verbose to give over radio. Maybe you could put it in the links for the show notes.
Sure, yeah, definitely, of course.
Blueshift.new, that's the main site.
Right, exactly. And we'll have that link, of course, and links directly to the books as well. Tons of interesting things in the books, of course, that we need to continue to talk about. But folks, if you want to find out more, definitely pick up a copy of one, the other, or both, of course. And stay with us. We'll continue in the second hour. Much more to talk with Christopher Hell about. We'll be right back. Stay with us in the members segment coming up. Christopher gets into the history of Olof Palme and the details of his assassination in 1986. We discuss the many faces of Palme, who at one time appeared to be working against the global agenda, but then later clearly with it. We consider the mysterious components of the submarine intrusion that linked him to the Soviet Union and an international plan to bring down Sweden. Christopher illustrates the many complicated facets of Palme's background, where implications of counterintelligence spying and blackmail leave many questions surrounding a much bigger and devious deep state game of destruction. Then we'll look at the long-term effects of Palme's political heritage and the role that Israel and Zionist money interests have played in the globalization game of the internationalists. Later, we return to the issues of Sweden becoming a cashless society and the changes to paper money that can be seen as symbolic gestures alluding to the war on the citizens and the rising technocratic system. In closing, we discuss the Sweden Democrats and its pro-Zionist leadership that has expelled true nationalists from the party. So sign up for a membership and get full access to our growing archives, over 1,000 shows and more added onto it every week. It's only €6 per month, and we have 3 months up to 2-year subscriptions available, and we also have a 3-month recurring one if you prefer that. RedIceMembers.com is the website. We have a great show coming up with Marcus Folin, a.k.a. The Golden One, together with Justin Garcia from The Pressure Project and Paul Wagner from The Wolves of Vinland, that you definitely shouldn't miss. This one is on the issues that men face and what to do about what is happening in our respective countries and how to prepare and get together with like-minded guys to build a functioning alternative to the degenerative effects of society that is closing in around us. We also have Brian Anspatrick on the zombie phenomena and gun culture, so some good shows is coming up. But stay tuned, because right now we have the second hour with Christopher Hell coming right up. So stay with us, and thank you again for listening.